The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Chapter 7 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Head-Hunting Jivaros. Probably the most warlike Indians in all South America are the Jivaros, who live in the forests of eastern Ecuador. They are man-hunters who preserve the heads of their slain enemies as trophies of war. I have seen several such heads during my travels and was once offered one for $100 in gold. I refused to buy it lest the ghost of the dead man haunt me the rest of my life. The head was about as big as my fist, the bones of the skull having been removed and the flesh so skillfully shrunken that none of the features were lost. The skin was black and the long thick hair was of the same raven hue. The nose was almost negroid in shape, and the lips were sewed together with cotton strands that hung down like a fringe. When the Indians discovered that travelers and scientists were willing to pay high prices for these cured heads, they began to kill their enemies on the slightest pretext. The supply still not meeting the demand, the warriors cast aside their few remaining scruples and killed members of their own tribes and sold their heads. Since then, the government has passed a law making it a crime to buy or sell zambas, or cured heads, and the severest penalties are now imposed upon anyone caught engaging in the traffic. After killing his victim, the Jivaros cuts off the head close to the shoulders and carries it to camp. There he opens it, crushes the skull, and takes out the bones. The skin is then sewed together from the crown to the base of the neck and painted with the juice of the huito, a fruit that looks much like an aguacate pear. This juice is a preservative and is smeared on both sides inside and out. The head is next filled with hot sand to preserve its shape. As the flesh dries, it is pressed inward from time to time, and some of the sand removed, until the head is reduced to 1/4 or 1/5 of its original size. As it grows smaller, a stone is inserted, and the flesh is worked down upon it. This stone is taken out before the skin has grown too hard, but not until after the features are fixed. The head is then hung up over a fire to be cured by the smoke. The story is told that a red-whiskered German came out to Ecuador some years ago to learn the head-curing process. He went to Quito and then made his way eastward to the Indian country. He was never seen again, but about 3 months after his disappearance, a beautifully cured head was brought in for sale. The skin was light, and the features were Teutonic in cast, while on the chin was a beard the color of brick dust. A tale is also current that another Teuton, whose head was sought by the Jivaros, was no less a personage than Kaiser Wilhelm himself. In 1918, when newspapers all over America published the opinions of various readers as to what should be done with the Kaiser, it is said that the following advertisement appeared in a Riobamba newspaper. The Head of the Kaiser. To him who produces it, I offer a prize of 1,000 sucres to convert it into a zamba and keep it as a war trophy. This offer was signed by an agent of the Jivaros, one of the few white men who have ever been on friendly terms with them. Being able to speak their language fluently, he had endeavored to tell them of the World War, which was then at its height. As a result, he was directed by the Jivaro chief to make the above announcement. The Jivaro Indians are well-built, good-looking men. They are polygamists, some of them having 7 or 8 wives. One reason for this is that when a girl marries, all her sisters become wives also and share the husband with her. They have large families, but the population is kept down by feuds, during which one family will lie in ambush for another and kill any of its members on sight. In order to be ready to defend themselves, they sometimes sleep in a sitting position, each brave having his spear between his knees. These Indians are very superstitious. They have witch doctors who brew a tea called Biabuasa from the roots and the leaves of a shrub. The drink has the effect of opium in that it makes one dream and see visions. An American with whom I have talked tried it once. Shortly afterward, spots began to dance before his eyes, and a little later he saw pictures of saints. The witch doctor told him to concentrate his mind on his family. He did so, and at first saw only snakes, but finally his family appeared before his mind's eye far more realistically than in any dream he had ever experienced before. The Jivaros live in villages, usually near a river or a small stream. Their houses are often 60 feet long and 30 feet wide, and are made of bamboo slats tied together on a framework of poles. The roof is of thatch, and there is a heavy wooden door at each end. Several families live in one house, the men sleeping at the front of the hut and the women at the back. The beds are long platforms, slightly higher than the level of the floor. Between these platforms and the fires, which are kept burning all night, are wooden poles that serve as footrests for the sleepers, who do not consider themselves comfortable unless they roast their toes. Hanging about the walls of the houses are the hunting equipment and the personal adornments of the men. The only other furnishings are the earthenware pots in which the women cook the meals. When a Jivaro dies in one of these dwellings, the body is buried under the house and the whole building burned down. The other occupants then move away and build another house. The favorite weapon of some of the Ecuadorian Indians is a reed blowgun, through which they shoot poisoned darts. These guns are long tubes, just large enough for the arrows, which are wrapped with cotton at the ends to make them fit closely. The arrows are not more than a foot or a foot and a half long, and not much thicker than a wooden toothpick. The poison with which their tips are smeared comes from Brazil. These blowguns have a range of from 40 to 50 feet, and with them, the Indians can hit a bird or a monkey perched in a treetop. For fighting, they use also spears, much like those of the knights of the Middle Ages. Some tribes poison their spears with the juice of a plant mixed with liquid from dead bodies in a state of putrefaction. They put up this preparation in earthenware jars or in joints of bamboo and make it an article of commerce among themselves. It is used also on hunting arrows to kill game and does not apparently poison the meat. I have talked with a German who has spent 3 years among the Indians of the Eastern Andes. He was twice wounded with poison arrows and had narrow escapes from the headhunters near the river Napo. He tells me that some of the Indians in that region wear in the lobes of their ears cylinders of wood or metal as big around as the bottom of a tumbler. The holes for these strange ornaments are first made during childhood and gradually enlarged by inserting bits of grass and twigs until they become big enough to hold the earplugs. The same custom prevails in Burma and in other parts of the Orient, while in the highlands of East Central Africa, I have seen earlobes stretch so much that when the plugs are taken out, they hang down like straps. Their owners sometimes fasten them over the top of the ears in order that they may not catch in the trees and brush of the forests. The few explorers who have made their way through the eastern slopes of the Andes from Ecuador to Bolivia say that cannibalism still exists among some of the Indian tribes. I have pictures of cannibal Indians called Cachibos who live along the river Pachitia in Peru. These people give as an excuse for the custom their belief that he who eats a man acquires all the courage and other good qualities possessed by the victim. Moreover, they say they would rather be eaten by men than by worms. The Cachibos hunt with blowguns and poison-tipped arrows. They do not know the use of money, and all their dealings are by barter. They wash gold from the streams and bring it to the traders as nuggets and coarse dust. The Aguarunas are a warlike tribe who fight with poisoned arrows and build war towers for defense. They are polygamous, and one man may have a half dozen wives. Both men and women wear nothing but short skirts of bark or cotton. Another curious tribe found farther south in Peru and Bolivia along the Madre de Dios River are called huachiperes. For personal adornment, They wear feathers and sticks thrust through holes pierced in their upper lips. They cultivate the soil and weave cloths and ropes of wild cotton. Like the Aguarunas and Jivaros, the men have several wives apiece. The warriors often make raids on the Quechuas, the descendants of the Incas who live on the high plateaus of the Andes, and steal the Quechua women to replenish their harems. Sometimes wives are bought and sold, the price of a woman being a knife or a hatchet. These Indians are unfriendly to the whites, and so far the missionaries have been able to do little with them. In contrast to the many fierce tribes of savages known as bad Indians are the Yumbos, or good Indians. For a long time they were in a state of peonage, and they are still submissive and willing to work for the whites for almost no wages. Although their customs show traces of the efforts of the Spaniards to Christianize them, they are superstitious to an extreme. During a severe epidemic of smallpox some years ago, when they died by the thousands, the survivors hid in the forest rather than submit to vaccination, which they believed would offend the evil one. The religion of the Indians of the eastern Andes is of the most primitive nature. Some tribes believe in a god and some in a future life, in which the soul goes through a series of transmigrations much like those described in the Buddhist faith. They say that the spirits of the good live again in jaguars and monkeys, while those of the evil inhabit the bodies of reptiles and parrots. Some of the Indian tribes believe there are two gods, one evil and one good, that fight for the control of mankind. The Conibos are sun worshippers, as were the Incas at the time of Pizarro. Nearly every tribe has its witch doctors, and all are honeycombed with a myriad of superstitions. Certain tribes have legends of the beginning of man. One is that when the world emerged from its original chaos, all mankind lived in a great cave, the entrance to which was guarded by a tiger. The human race was kept prisoner by this beast until one day the liberator of mankind, a giant among his fellows, fought with the tiger and killed it. Then man came out and populated the earth. After living so long in a cave, the people had become very dirty. They realized this when they reached the light of day and so decided to wash. They heated water in a colossal earthen jar. Those who got the first bath came out white, and thus the white race was created. Those who had the next bath were brown and formed the brown race. The last to bathe had only the dregs left in the jar, and so were black. Some of the tribes wear clothes made of tree bark. I have a blanket of bark cloth made by these Indians. It is as large as a bed quilt and as soft and pliable as though it were wool. I have rolled it up and carried it about in a shawl strap. Still, it is merely the unwoven bark of a tree. The Indians make cuttings about the tree, tear off the bark in sheets, and soak it in water, after which they pound off the rough outer layers. The inner layers are composed of fine fibers so knit together by nature that they are not unlike cloth. They are warm enough for blankets and soft enough to take the place of a mattress. The same sort of cloth is made in Uganda in tropical Africa, where it is a common article of clothing. Like the Africans, also, many of the South American savages are musical. They have reed or bone flutes and three-stringed violins. Drums made out of hollow logs are used for sending messages from camp to camp. None of these tribes associate with one another. They have no organized governments, and in each one, the chiefs are generally chosen for their superior ferocity and strength. Their languages differ widely, and there is no common method of writing. Some savages count by movements of the fingers, but all are in a low state of development and are sinking lower through contact with the vices and the liquor of the whites. Few of the South American Indians are equal, physically or mentally, to those of North America. Most of them are short in stature, and they vary in color from reddish brown to black. They have high cheekbones and black eyes with long, straight black hair. Some are very strong, and a few are brave, but the majority are cowardly and afraid of white men. These primitive peoples are widely scattered, and the social organization of many of them is in families rather than in tribes. There are probably not more than 100,000 all told on the eastern slopes of the Andes. The Geographical Society of Lima, Peru, estimates the number of savages in those regions at about 150,000. Indians form 3/4 of the population of Ecuador, but the majority of them are at least semi-civilized, as distinguished from the wild tribes I have described. These people do all the rough work of the country, and until 1918, most of them were practically the slaves of the landowners. Slavery did not, of course, exist as in the days of Pizarro, when the Indians were branded, whipped, and killed at the will of their owners, but it was enforced through the laws and customs by which the peons were kept in debt to their masters. Wages were low, and once an Indian got in debt, he found it almost impossible to get out. It was a common procedure for a planter who wanted laborers for his estate to go to the jails and settle the debts of such prisoners as agreed to work out the money thus paid. He then gave them very low wages and always held back a portion of what was due them. The farmhand was given a hut to live in and received a daily ration of a little meat, rice, or beans, and some lard or salt. He received also a hat, 3 coarse cotton shirts, and 3 pairs of cotton pantaloons a year. In addition, he was given a few cents in money. The hours of work were from sunrise to sunset, and when a man skipped a day, it was charged against his wages. The women and the children were forced to labor as well as the men. If a peon once was free from debt, the condition soon compelled him to become a debtor again. He had nothing ahead, and if there was a death in his family, he had to borrow money for the funeral. If he would be married by the priest, he was charged $6, and consequently many of the Indians were obliged to forego the ceremony. For this reason, it is said that 75% of the births in Ecuador formerly were illegitimate. In 1918, debt slavery was abolished by law, and since then conditions have greatly changed for the better. Although the lot of the unskilled Indian laborer and his family is still a hard one, wages and living conditions in general have been much improved. Some of the workers have organized themselves into unions and have thus been able to make better terms with their employers. The government also is doing much to give these people the advantages of education and modern civilization. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Down the Desert Coast of Peru. I have come from the jungles of the Ecuadorian tropics to the desert of Peru, a region as barren as any part of the Sahara. From the ocean to the Andes, it is nothing but sand and rock, and the mountains themselves are as sterile as the driest part of our great western plateau. Peru is divided naturally into 3 zones. The first is this desert coastal region. The second consists of the high Andean valleys and plateaus, upheld by the 3 parallel ranges of these mighty mountains. And the third slopes eastward from the Andes to the Amazon Valley. The latter region, which forms the larger part of the republic, has never been thoroughly explored. Peru extends north and south through 1/4 of the length of the entire Andean highland. It is more than 1,000 miles long, and in places more than 700 miles wide. If it could be laid down on the United States, with the Chilean boundary at New Orleans, southern Ecuador would be somewhere near Minneapolis, and the country would extend from the Mississippi River eastward to Pittsburgh. Peru is equal to more than 1/5 of the area of the United States, and is 6 times as large as Great Britain and Ireland. There is enough of it to make 14 states as big as New York and one of its departments, the name of which many of you have never heard, is larger than Texas. That is Loreto, at the headwaters of the Amazon. The department of Cusco in southern Peru is nearly as big as California, and there are other departments almost as large. The South American desert begins south of Tumbes, near the Ecuador-Peru boundary, and extends from there southward along the western coast of the continent for 2,000 miles. It borders the whole of Peru and reaches down into northern Chile, almost to Valparaiso. In no place is it more than 90 miles wide. At its eastern edge, it is merged with the Andes, which from their foothills to their snow-capped peaks are practically without vegetation. I have seen something of the other great deserts of the world. I have been on the edge of the Kalahari in South Africa, and I have traveled through the Sahara from Morocco to the Valley of the Nile. I have sailed along the coast of Arabia, and I know something of Gobi on the edge of Mongolia. None of them is like the Peruvian desert, and none seems to be so fated to remain barren for all time to come. This desert forms a strip between the ocean and the Great Wall of the Andes. Those mountains rise almost precipitously from this long coastal plain. It is so cold at the great height of their peaks that winds from the east lose all their moisture by condensation before they reach the Pacific slope. It is this phenomenon that causes the rains that cover eastern South America with tropical verdure and gives the valleys of the Amazon and the Parana the greatest water supply known to man. But while most of the continent blooms like a garden, the lands west of the Andes have practically no rain. Throughout this desert strip of 2,000 miles, nearly all the water comes from the little rivers that have their sources in the melting snows on the tops of the mountains. It rains so seldom that there are people living on the coast who have not seen an umbrella in 20 years, and who get a good laugh over the occasional American who comes here to sell waterproof coats and rubber boots. Parts of the desert of Peru are rocky, like much of the Sahara, and parts are covered with sand as fine as that surrounding the pyramids on the banks of the Nile. In some places, the sand gathers in great crescent-shaped dunes that move over the desert. The strong south winds roll the sand grains up over the top of the crescent, which, like the crest of a wave, moves steadily onward. The shifting dunes climb the hills and make their way through the valleys. They will not stop for roads or railways, and it is impossible to keep them back by windbreaks or fences. Some of the railways that cross the desert have been covered over again and again, and it is repeatedly necessary to dig out the tracks so that trains may pass. The sand often covers up the trails and frequently blots out landmarks. The only fertile regions of the desert are where the snow-fed rivers from the mountains cross it on their way to the sea. There are 55 such streams along the coast of Peru, and it is estimated that they make it possible to irrigate an area of 50 million acres. About 2 million acres are now cultivated, producing large crops of sugar and cotton. American tractors are used on the bigger plantations, and there are many sugar factories with modern machinery. These oases comprise the most important agricultural lands of Peru. They feed the greater number of the people and supply much of the export products of the republic. My first port of call along the coast of Peru was Payta. It has streets of sand and sidewalks of wood. Most of the one- and two-story houses are of recent construction, as many of the buildings of the town were burned some years ago by a commission appointed to eradicate yellow fever and bubonic plague. The older structures are painted all the colors of the rainbow. The customs house, for example, is bright green, and when I passed through the plaza behind it, I faced a church of sky blue surrounded by buildings as yellow as gold. The plaza contains about the only bit of vegetation in the whole town. This is a garden no larger than an ordinary room filled with stunted palm trees and thirsty-looking plants. Although a few motor trucks and automobiles are now in use in Payta and in other parts of the Piura district, donkeys form most of the traffic of the city. I saw caravans of them bringing vegetables, sugar, and rice to the port, and when I went to the post office, I walked along beside the mail wagon, which was a dray drawn by a mule. Much of the drinking water is peddled from house to house in 10-gallon kegs carried by donkeys. Payta has a railroad to the Piura Valley, which is about 60 miles inland. I am told that this road may be extended a distance of 400 miles over the Andes to connect with the Maranon River, one of the great tributaries of the Amazon. This extension would give Payta direct connection with the upper Amazon Valley and would bring one of the most fertile parts of South America within a few days' travel of the Panama Canal. The Piura Valley is one of the richest of the desert oases. It produces the famous native cotton of Peru. Thousands of bales of this cotton, comprising 60% of the total crop, are shipped to the United States, where it brings several cents a pound more than the cotton raised in our southern states. Practically all the rest of the yield goes to England. This Peruvian rough cotton, as it is called, has a heavy, kinky fiber and looks and feels like wool. It is usually spun on woolen machinery and is mixed with wool in the manufacture of hats, hosiery, and underwear. It is said to give wool and cotton mixed cloth a finer luster and to render it less liable to shrinkage than do other varieties of cotton. Indeed, this land seems to have been one of the first homes of cotton. The plant was growing here when Pizarro came, and he found cotton cloth in the tombs of people who lived long before the Incas. The Incas undoubtedly sold it also to tribes in other parts of South America, as mummies wrapped in cloth made of this characteristic Peruvian cotton have been found along the Amazon in Brazil. The Peruvian variety grows on a tree that bears for 20 years. The common method of planting is to put the seeds in the ground with a stick and let the trees grow to a height of 6 or 8 feet. After that, they are cut back from year to year in order that the crop be more easily gathered. The picking is done by native men, women, and children, who also sort the cotton by color before it is ginned. I say by color, for much of the Peruvian product is brown or red. Brown and white varieties grow on the same tree, and there may be brown and white lint in the same bowl. The colored cotton is sold largely to the Indians, who use it for their ponchos and hammocks. While most of the crop is exported, some of it is manufactured in this country. There are several cotton factories in Peru, all but two or three of which are in Lima. The Peruvians are now growing also upland cotton and Sea Island cotton from American seed. The Sea Island cotton has but a small acreage, its production being limited to a few little valleys. The upland cotton here yields for 3 years in succession without replanting. Payta is near Peru's most important oil-producing region. My steamer brought here 2 barge loads of iron pipe and 8-inch cast iron casings for the Lobitos oil fields, which are situated along the coast not far from here. Farther south, I saw from the boat the derricks of the petroleum port of Talara. There are oil wells at Tumbes, and there is a refinery at Zorritos, where between 40 and 50 wells are producing. Oil is being found also in southern Peru, and even on the shores of Lake Titicaca, 2 miles above the sea, where it has been struck at a depth of about 800 feet. The annual petroleum exports of Peru are worth more than $20 million, and the business is still only at its beginning. The oil is of a high grade, and it can be used for lighting as well as for fuel. The steamer upon which I am traveling down the coast burns fuel oil instead of coal, and is taken on a fresh supply at Payta, where oil is stored in a great round tank on the bluffs above the town. A pipeline runs down to the ocean, and the fuel is brought out to the steamer in a little oil barge. As at most of these West Coast ports, steamer passengers are landed at Payta in small boats. There are few harbors, and vessels must usually lie in the open roadsteads and transfer cargo by lighters. The moment our ship came to anchor off Payta, white boats with red flags started out from the shore. They were rowed by barefooted, blue-clad Indian sailors with white caps on their heads. Behind them came the small craft of the natives, bringing vegetables and other products out to the steamer. And still farther back were tugs towing the great barges loaded with freight to be taken on board. Among the merchandise the natives brought out to the ship were the finest of Panama hats. I bought one for about $10, although the first price of the Indian salesman was £6, or $30. I offered him £1, 10 shillings, and he came down to £5. At the last moment, he took £2. The hat is as closely woven as the finest of silk, and so soft that I can bundle it up in my pocket and hardly know it is there. The straws are no bigger around than a needle. The Panama hats that are now sold so largely in our stores are not made in Panama. They come from Ecuador, Colombia, and northern Peru. They are shipped from here all over North America, as well as to Germany, France, and England, and to other parts of South America. The Ecuadorians are now also exporting the straw, much of which comes down into Peru, where it is made into hats. Ordinary Panamas, such as are commonly sold in our stores, can be bought in Payta for $1 or $2 apiece. They come chiefly from Guayaquil, which exports several hundred dozen of them every month. The very finest Panamas cost so much that there is practically no demand for them abroad. Some, which sell here for as high as $100, would cost twice as much in New York. One, made several years ago as a present to the King of England, was so finely woven that it could be folded into a package no larger than a man's watch. That hat was more than 6 months in the making. It was of the finest straw, and the work upon it was done only during certain hours of the morning and evening, when the amount of moisture in the air was just right. The Panama hat is made from the leaf of a palm called the toquilla. This tree is now cultivated. It becomes full grown at 18 months and lives for 40 years or more. The straws are made from the new leaves, which are cut off just as they are about to unfold, and split with needles or with the fingernail. At the port of Iten, which was our next stop after Payta, the sea was so rough that passengers were lowered from the ship to small boats in a barrel, which had been turned into a chair by cutting part of it away. Travelers were brought aboard from the boats alongside in the same manner. I saw three women thus lifted. One of them wrapped her head in her shawl and seemed to be praying fervently all the way up. Steaming on to the south, we came to Pascomayo, which, with its low white buildings and flat roofs, looks like a town of Arabia. It lies on the coast, with the desert and the mountains behind it. It has a steel pier built by the American engineer Henry Meigs when he was constructing railroads in this part of South America. From the town, a little railway runs back into the valley to Chilete, and thence northward to Guadalupe. This line may some day be extended to the Amazon region by an easy pass over the mountains. High in the Andes, not far from Pascomayo, is Cajamarca, where the Indian king, Atahualpa, was put to death by Pizarro, the Spanish invader. Arriving at this northern capital of the Inca Empire on the 15th of November, 1532, Pizarro found it a well-built city lying in the beautiful valley of a little river, the waters of which irrigated many fields and gardens. The use of the buildings of the town as quarters for his troops was offered Pizarro by Atahualpa, who also sent a message from his camp some distance away that he would visit the Spaniard the following day. Thereupon Pizarro conceived a plan to seize the king and ordered his soldiers to arm themselves but to keep out of sight when Atahualpa arrived. Early the next morning, the Inca army left the royal camp and proceeded to Cajamarca. Pizarro had with him only a handful of men and horses, but the native monarch was preceded by so many soldiers that it was almost nightfall before the last of them arrived in the city. As Atahualpa was born before Pizarro, he was met and addressed by the friar, Vicente de Valverde, who extended a cross in one hand and a Bible in the other. Valverde's words, whether intentionally or because of their faulty translation by the interpreter, offended the Inca monarch, who disdained the offerings and threw them to the ground. At this action, Valverde, who has been depicted by many historians as a rascally troublemaker, shouted to the hidden Spanish soldiers, "Fall on, I absolve you." In the slaughter that followed, hundreds of Indians were killed and Atahualpa was taken prisoner. The person of the Inca king was so sacred that his capture paralyzed the nation, and in spite of their overwhelming numbers, the Indians seemed helpless. Atahualpa then said if Pizarro would release him, he would fill the room in which he was confined with gold to a point as high as he could reach. This offer was accepted, and for several weeks gold was brought in great loads from all parts of Peru. The room was 17 feet long and 20 feet wide, and the point up to which it was to be filled was designated by a red mark 9 feet above the floor. The treasure was in many forms. Some of it consisted of gold plates torn from the Temple of the Sun at Cuzco. There were golden basins, drinking cups, vases of all kinds, and many objects of the finest workmanship, beautifully carved. When the room was almost filled up to the mark indicated, Pizarro ordered the Indian goldsmiths to melt it all into ingots. There was so much gold that they worked day and night for a month at the task. Then Pizarro refused to let Atahualpa go, and after a trial that was a mockery of justice, had him strangled to death. A prison now covers the spot where the palace stood, and in one of its rooms is a stone that the Indians say is still stained with Atahualpa's blood. Salaverry, not far south of Pascomayo, is an important sugar-exporting town. It is the port for Trujillo, a city of about 15,000 or 20,000 people. Trujillo was founded by Pizarro in 1535 and was named in memory of his native town in Spain. Nearby are ruins of an ancient city built by the Yuncas, one of the tribes conquered by the Incas. There are many ruins of Indian cities scattered over the Peruvian desert, and from some of them have been dug mummies in an excellent state of preservation. The desert air is as dry and healthful as that of Egypt. As in Egypt, it is the dryness that accounts for the good conditions of the centuries-old mummies dug up here. Most of the mummies found in Peru showed that the corpse was placed in a sitting position, wrapped in cloth, and bound with string. During a former trip to this country, I visited a number of cities from which such mummies had been dug, and I saw piles 15 feet high containing skulls that had been taken from the excavation. Some of the ruins in this desert are the remains of cities that were in existence long before the Incas came. In the Xequatepecua Valley, back of Pacasmayo, I saw a large mound that was once the site of a palace, or possibly a temple to the Vestal Virgins of the Sun. All about were bits of pottery molded by the people of an unknown nation of the past. The ruins showed that the building was nearly square and 500 feet wide at the base. Its adobe walls had been plastered on the outside with mud and washed with color. In other parts of the desert, earthen vessels have been found that are believed to have been made by a people who were old when the pyramids of Egypt were young. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The City of Pizarro. Climb with me to the rocky top of San Cristobal and take a look over Lima, the capital of Peru. We are on the edge of the Rimac Valley, within 8 miles of the Pacific Ocean and about 1,000 feet above it. From here, the sea seems a wide streak of silver, beyond which are the mountainous islands that border the coast. At the water's edge is the port of Callao, and directly opposite it, the island of San Lorenzo. Behind us, half hidden in the clouds, is the westernmost range of the Andes, where, in awful pride, enthroned above the skies, peaks upon peaks in matchless grandeur rise, mid frowning glaciers on whose snowy crest the savage vulture builds its craggy nest. San Cristobal is a bare hill of the desert, rising 900 feet above Lima. Its summit can be reached on foot or by an aerial tramway. On top of the hill, rising 350 feet still higher into the air, are the steel towers of a radio station, from which messages are sent over the high wall of the Andes to the government station at Iquitos in the heart of the rubber country of the Amazon Valley, and even across the continent to Rio de Janeiro. From the top of San Cristobal, we could throw stones upon the roofs of Lima beneath us. The city is a vast expanse of low, flat-roofed buildings, most of them of one or two stories, above which rise a cathedral and many churches. Almost directly below us is the great round Plaza de Toros, the immense bull ring where fights are held every Sunday, and where the Limenos come by the thousands to see their favorite matadors butcher the bulls. Some of these people seem to be quite as bloodthirsty as those who watched the gladiatorial fights of ancient Rome. Only last Sunday, when the bulls were not considered as fierce as they should be, the crowd hissed the fighters and drove them out of the ring. They had even begun to tear up the seats and set fire to the building when the police rushed in and restored order. In recent years, boxing and horse racing have grown in popularity, and the latter now rivals bullfighting as a favorite sport. The Jockey Club of Lima is famous all over the West Coast, and during the races are held from July to December, leaders of society, including the president and his officials, are frequently in attendance. The winding stream that runs through the city is the Rimac River. It springs forth from the glaciers of the Andes and gives life to the valleys below, providing water to irrigate the orchards, the vineyards, and the fields of grain along its course. Lima is built in the Peruvian desert, and the irrigated lands that surround it are scattered through 15 small valleys. They are divided into about 180 estates, many of which are large holdings. Practically the whole support of the city comes from this region and from its trade with the rest of Peru. Lima was founded by Pizarro only 43 years after Columbus discovered America. In honor of the sovereigns of Spain, he called it Ciudad de los Reyes, or the City of the Kings, and it was so known for a long time afterward. The present name of Lima is a corruption of the word Rimac, the name of the river on which it is built. The city had grown great 100 years before the ground on which Chicago now stands was trodden by the feet of white men. It was the capital of all South America when our country was subject to England, and today it is one of the most interesting cities upon the two continents. But let us go down from San Cristobal and make our way over the Rimac to the main part of the city. One of the first places we visit is the museum, which vies with the one at Cairo in its relics of a bygone civilization. Its collections of potteries, textiles, and mummies depict not only the handicraft of the Inca regime, but of the more ancient civilizations of centuries before. Side by side with these objects of antiquity are many evidences of modern Peru and its progress in commerce and industry. One of them is the remains of the first airplane to cross the Alps, in which a young Peruvian aviator lost his life. Lima is sprinkled with great plazas or squares containing fountains and gardens, and extending out from these run narrow thoroughfares, other streets crossing them at right angles. The main business streets are not more than 30 feet wide, and the car tracks are so close to the sidewalk that one has to be careful lest he lose a leg as he walks along. Another thing that makes a visitor to Lima stay on the alert to keep his bearings is the system by which the streets are named. In addition to a thoroughfare having a designation for its entire length, each block has also an individual name. The buildings are close to the street, and in the residential section of the ground floor, windows are barred. The houses of two or three stories have balconies that extend out over the sidewalks. Some of these balconies are so wonderfully carved that they make me think of the harem quarters of Cairo or Old Spain. In the business parts of the city, where most of the stores have living quarters above them, one sees long lines of them stretching from one end of the street to the other. Lima has practically no backyards, and only in the suburbs are there outside gardens. Most of the residences surround courts or patios upon which the principal rooms face. The larger houses cover a good deal of ground, a single one sometimes having 20 or more rooms and several large courts in which are fountains, growing plants, and even trees. Often the rooms that do not open on the court are lighted by little dormer windows that extend up through the flat roofs and look like chicken coops. It is difficult, in fact, to tell the dormers from the real chicken coops. There are thousands of chickens that are hatched, lay their eggs, and grow fat for the kitchens on the roofs of this city. On a previous visit here, I was awakened every night by the crowing of the cocks above me. There was one asthmatic old rooster that crowed me awake regularly at 5 a.m., and another that sometimes made the air shake at midnight. I have not yet seen a cow on the roofs, though I am told that some families have their stables so located, the cattle not being taken down until they are to be killed. Nowhere are there any chimneys to be seen. Practically all the cooking in Lima is done over charcoal, the fumes of which escape at best they can. During recent years, electric stoves have come into use. Many of the older buildings are beautiful and exceedingly comfortable. Some of them are constructed of sun-dried brick, and some have roofs of plaster spread over a framework of wood lathed with bamboo canes. The outer walls are covered with stucco, and such buildings have a substantial appearance in spite of their flimsy construction. Of late, many fine houses of reinforced concrete have been put up, and along the avenue of the Exposition, for instance, are residences that would be considered fine anywhere in the world. This street is almost as wide as Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, and has along its center a continuous garden of flowers, shrubs, and trees. It is a popular place in the afternoons when the sidewalks are crowded with promenaders and processions of motors and smart carriages move along the pavement. Lima has almost 200,000 inhabitants and is steadily growing. Its population and business have increased since the opening of the Panama Canal, and when it has better hotels, it will be as delightful a city as one can find along the West Coast. Its resorts on the Bay of Corilos, where regattas and water sports are held each summer, are already popular places for both Peruvians and foreigners. In winter, because of the heavy fogs near the sea, many of the people go inland to Chosica in the Andean foothills. But let us leave the streets and go into the cathedral. It's in the heart of the city, and its towers can be seen from almost anywhere in the Rimac Valley. It faces the Plaza de Armas with its palm trees and its beautiful fountains, and is said to be the finest church edifice on the American continent, with the single exception of the cathedral in Mexico City. It was founded by Pizarro before John Smith landed at Jamestown. 90 years were taken to complete it, and although it has been damaged again and again by earthquakes, each time it has been rebuilt. The interior of the cathedral is impressive. The high altar is of massive silver construction, and the stalls of the sanctuary are fine specimens of the best carving done by the Indians when that art was still in its prime. On the walls are fine paintings by Murillo and other masters, and the chapels are of exceeding beauty. I was especially impressed by the chapel of Pizarro. The little verger of the cathedral took me into it, and under the altar he showed me the coffin in which lie Pizarro's bones. The casket is of white marble with glass sides and top. The verger lighted a candle and waved it up and down over the glass, and as he did so I could see all that is now left of the first Spaniard to explore and conquer the west coast of South America. His skeleton, which is as black as old mahogany and looks as though it were varnished, lies upon a red velvet cushion embroidered with gold. The skull, which rests on a pillow, is fastened to his backbone by wires through the ears. The jaw is a trifle drooping, the nose is prominent, and the great eyeless socket stared up at me as I gazed down through the top of the casket. As I looked more closely, the whole seemed merely a shell. The shins have begun to peel, showing the honeycombed structure of the bone beneath. I am told that in times past, pieces have been cut off and given to relic hunters, but as far as I could see, most of the skeleton is intact, though decidedly leathery and the worse for wear. From the outside of the coffin, I copied these words: Capitán General Don Francisco Pizarro, Fundador de Lima, on 18 de enero de 1535, Muerto on 26 de junio de 1541. It was on the latter date that Pizarro was murdered by followers of his former partner as a result of a quarrel over the division of the Inca territory. Lima has 70 churches in all, and nearly every one is worth visiting. The church and convent of San Francisco are said to have cost $2 million. The altar of Santa Rosa, the patron saint of Lima, had in it at one time 1,500 pounds of gold and silver, and jewels that included 1,400 diamonds, 1,200 emeralds, 600 rubies, and 120 fine pearls. Lima appears to be a godly city, although there is a Methodist bishop here in my hotel who says it is the most bigoted on earth. There are priests and nuns everywhere, and great monasteries and convents galore. Most of the people are devout churchgoers, and on Sunday morning the streets are filled with families on their way to Mass. Although on other days the women wear as gay apparel as in our own cities, many of them attend Sunday services clad all in black. The usual headdress is a black cloth or lace mantilla, covering the hair and the neck so that only the face is visible. I am told that in some churches women are not supposed to enter wearing a hat, and that those who do so are tapped with a long stick by the sexton and told to remove their headgear. The men sit by themselves on one side of the church, and the women have their seats on the other. I find that there is a great movement going on in this country for freedom of religious worship. Laws have been passed by the National Congress making it possible for any person to establish any kind of church anywhere he pleases. Previously, the Protestant missionaries had not been permitted to introduce their religion in the interior. Women also are demanding greater freedom and are beginning to take their place in the business and professional world. One woman has organized a sort of nursery hospital for children, and another has opened a woman's exchange where needlework and other articles may be bought and sold. Many are teachers, and hundreds are stenographers and typists. The changing idea regarding the feminine sex was reflected in a much-talked-of float at the celebration of the Peruvian centennial. It was called The Lima That Is Passing, and showed, among other things, a señorita wearing her black manta peering out from behind the shelter of her barred balcony windows. Girl students are now enrolled in the University of San Marcos at Lima, the oldest in all America, which was founded a century before Harvard. It was modeled after the ancient University of Salamanca, and though it has been destroyed again and again by earthquake and siege, it stands today as the foremost institution of learning in Peru. Near the cathedral and facing the plaza is the National Palace, where I called upon some of the government officials. It was built about the same time as the cathedral and has all the features of Spanish architecture in the days of Columbus. It covers a whole city block and has several patios in which are royal palms and tropical flowers. On my way, I was shown a fig tree said to have been planted by Pizarro. It is more than 300 years old and is still bearing fruit. The government palace formerly contained the residence and offices of the president of Peru. I have interviewed two presidents of this country and have talked with them about its progress and development. Not long ago, the government brought in experts from the United States to assist in formulating new methods of administration. As a result, improvements in the national commercial and educational systems have been affected, sanitary conditions bettered, and police and harbor regulations revised. The president is elected by a direct vote of the people for a term of 5 years. He has a cabinet of 5 members. The legislative branch of the government is divided between a Senate of 35 members and a House of Representatives of 110. The Senate occupies a building on the Plaza Bolivar that was once the seat of the Spanish Inquisition, and in front of which hundreds of victims were executed and burned to death. The interior of the Inquisition chamber is lined with beautiful woodwork, the ceiling especially being noted for the rare and intricate designs of the carving. In contrast to the old-world beauty of the room is an interesting and up-to-date device by which members vote on questions before the Senate. Each desk is equipped with an electric button, which, when pressed, registers the vote at the presiding officer's table. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. In the shops and markets of Lima. I have just returned from a morning in the city market of Lima. I arrived at the market house at 7 o'clock and ate my desayuno at a little restaurant among the stalls. This meal, which the Peruvians eat upon rising, consists of 2 small pieces of toast and a cup of coffee or tea. The real breakfast is not eaten till 11 or 12 o'clock. Being afflicted with a good American appetite, I pieced out the scanty menu with a bunch of white grapes as big as my head, the grapes themselves being the size of damson plums. The table was large, and I had hardly taken my seat before an Indian woman with a broad-brimmed Panama hat coming well over her bronzed features sat down opposite me and ordered some ice cream, which was served in a champagne glass. Then a pockmarked Peruvian of the lower class took a seat at the table, and just as I was about to leave, a fat old negress wearing a black manta that covered the entire upper part of her body and all of her head except her face slid down into a chair beside me. While eating, I was besieged by all sorts of peddlers, from women who offered me lottery tickets to men who were selling waxen images of the Virgin Mary dressed in the latest styles. All about were the queer characters that make up the masses of the Peruvian capital. There were cooks by the hundreds doing their daily marketing. Some were Chinese, some Negroes, and many had the yellow skins that showed their combined Indian and Spanish ancestry. There were scores of women dressed all in black, and many in calico dresses and straw hats. Not a few were mountain folk, and they looked about with eyes of wonder at the strange sights of the great city. The crowd numbered thousands and was the busiest assemblage I have seen in Peru. The Lima market covers a city square, the chief stalls being in a great court roofed with galvanized iron and surrounded by stores. As I strolled among the fruit peddlers, I saw white and red grapes, apples as yellow as gold, and rosy peaches, as well as pomegranates, guavas, and tunas, the fruit of the cactus. There were oranges, lemons, pineapples, and bananas, and bushels of alligator pears. The latter cost only 5 or 10 cents each, yet I had to pay 50 cents for the one I ordered with my dinner at the hotel yesterday. Among the vegetables were string beans as long as my arm and yuccas as big around as a baseball bat and often 2 feet in length. They are the roots of a species of lily plant and are eaten like potatoes. I saw roasting ears at nearly every vegetable stand. Some of them were bright yellow and others as black as my boots. I saw grains of hominy twice the size of the largest lima beans. They come from a corn grown here that is so mealy that the Indians make flour of it by pounding it with a stone. There were many tomatoes, great heads of cauliflower and cabbage, musk melons and watermelons, and other fruits the names of which I do not know. A large part of the market is devoted to meats and game. I saw lamb, kid flesh, and great cages of guinea pigs, which when cooked taste like squab pigeons or tender young squirrels. There were stalls full of corbina, which is a large and sweet-fleshed fish, not unlike the bluefish of the Atlantic, though of a more delicate flavor. A certain variety of Peruvian fish is considered especially delicious when served raw with the juice of a lemon. The acid seems to have the same effect on the flesh as boiling, and it is thought even better than the raw fish eaten in Japan. There are also many kinds of shellfish, including a clam called the señorita. Its flesh is as white as snow, except for a morsel of meat the color of the brightest red pepper. About the only seafood I have eaten here that I do not like is the Peruvian oyster, which is parboiled and served on the half shell. There is no place that I have yet visited that has so much pepper and potatoes upon its table as I find here. It is said that the Peruvians eat more pepper than salt. They serve it with nearly everything, and one always finds beside his plate a little dish of a sort of red pepper paste called ají. Papas con ají is a favorite concoction made of potatoes and pepper with a sauce of tomatoes and eggs. It is as hot as fire, but not bad after you get used to it. Papas relleno is made of mashed potatoes mixed with olives, onions, eggs, and raisins, and fried. Papas con arroz is potatoes cooked with rice. The chief meal of many of the poorer classes of people is a soup made by cooking together nearly every kind of vegetable and a goodly portion of meat. The soup is drained off and served clear, and the vegetables and the meat are brought in on a separate plate to be eaten afterward. Peru, it seems to me, is the paradise of the housekeeper. There are few places where it is easier to manage a home than here. The cooks do all the marketing, the ladies of Lima seldom going out of the house except to shop or visit. The cook is allowed a certain amount of money a day for which he is expected to supply the meals. In other words, you board with your cook. If you have a good one, you are better and more cheaply served than if you try to manage it all yourself. At the same time, the cook usually makes a profit from the marketing allowance in addition to his wages. Servants are cheap in Peru. The native families pay less than the foreigners, and in the country districts, there are many house servants who do not get much more than their board and clothes. Outside of the market, much of the peddling of Lima is done by women, who ride on horseback from house to house. Nearly all the milk is carried in cans tied to the sides of a horse, upon the back of which the woman sits with her legs straddling the animal's neck. When she reaches a house where she has a customer, she slides down over the horse's neck, lifts off one of the cans, carries it inside, and pours out a quart or a pint according to order. There are also many women vegetable peddlers. Other peddlers are men and boys who sit just in front of the tails of their donkeys with their backs against their loads of goods. There are no huckster wagons, and the drays of the city are long-bodied, two-wheeled carts, each pulled by three mules abreast. In the chief shopping section, only the newest of the stores have plate glass windows, and there are no fancy fronts with gorgeous displays that may be looked at Sundays and evenings. Most of the stores have no windows at all. They are shut in from the street by great doors that are removed during business hours. The sunlight comes in through the door or from the roof. The shops are separated only by thin walls, and strolling along in front of them is like walking through a museum or an oriental bazaar. The sidewalks are narrow and the merchandise is displayed close to the streets. Many of the dry goods stores hang fancy patterns of cloth from the ceiling, and the larger establishments have piles of goods stacked upon the floor near the street. Notions of every kind are hung from strings stretched from wall to wall, and all sorts of unusual ways of display are contrived. As a rule, the prices are high. The best from all over the world is brought here for sale, for this city, while not a rich one, has thousands of well-to-do people. They make as many trips to Europe as do our own wealthy families. Their children are educated abroad, and the women frequently go to Paris to buy the latest styles in clothes. The chief shopping hours are from 4 to 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Then the streets are thronged with men and women, and the crowd is as great as that on F Street in Washington at about the same time of day. One difference here is that no one is in a hurry. The people saunter along or stop and chat with their friends. Nearly everyone is well-dressed, and nearly every man, old and young, carries a cane. There are many women wearing the fashionable styles of today, and there are also many who are clad in the dead black that the Lady of Lima of the past always wore when she went out to walk. Such women do not wear hats, but instead wrap a shawl of fine black goods about the head, pinning it back so that the face alone shows. This background adds to their beauty, and the costume is more becoming than the changing fashions. There is no business done in Lima on the Sabbath. The stores are closed, and the great doors fastened with padlocks. There is not a sign of goods of any kind to be seen. Sometimes there is a grating at the top of the door for ventilation, and sometimes a round hole has been made lower down, so that if the owner is within, he may look out, but there is no sign of business anywhere. This is so also in the evenings of weekdays. Nearly all the stores close at 6 o'clock, and after dark the movies are almost deserted, except near the movies. The barricades in the past have protected the merchants' stocks in times of political disturbances and revolutions. I find American goods for sale in all the stores, although the merchants are mostly English and German, with some Peruvians and a number of Chinese and Italians. The hardware stores carry American axes, hatchets, and other tools, and there are many agencies for American machinery. Much of the cotton print cloth comes from our country, and American canned goods have a great sale here. If I want to pay high prices, I can buy a pair of shoes made in the United States, or one of our American hats sold in competition with those from England and France. The Peruvians have mills not far from Cusco, where they are turning out blankets and underwear, but most of their other woolens still come from abroad. Just now the stores are showing more and more goods from Germany, which is successfully reestablishing its pre-war market in Peru. An American enterprise that is doing much for our trade with Peru is the publication of the West Coast Leader, a weekly paper printed in English here in Lima. This journal is devoted to opening up Peru to English and American capital and to the pushing of foreign trade. Its editor was for a long time a newspaper man in the United States. At the present time, the chief North American firm doing business on the west coast of South America is the house of W.R. Grace & Company. It has its head offices in London and New York, with branches in Peru, Bolivia, and Chile. This company, which has been operating here for more than a generation, deals in all kinds of merchandise, from a small package of goods to rolling stock for a railroad, and it handles big contracts involving millions of dollars. The Graces have long run a line of steamers from New York to Western South America. The company is known everywhere for the ability and probity of its officials and members, and it is an institution of which the United States may well be proud. Another opportunity for American capital down here is in the establishment of a line of first-class hotels along the West Coast. There should be one at Guayaquil, another at Quito, and a third at Lima. Since the opening of the Panama Canal, there has been a great increase in tourist travel to this part of the world. But at present, the hotel accommodations are, to say the least, very poor, and the rates are about as high as at home. I have been stopping here at the Mori, one of a chain of a half dozen hotels under the same ownership. It vies with the Grand as the best hotel in Peru. It is a great two-story structure with wide balconies. The best accommodations I could get were a room facing the street, and back of it a little dark sitting room. There are no private bathrooms, yet the Mori is usually filled, and I understand that it is paying big dividends. The port of entry for Lima is the coast city of Callao, which for all practical purposes has become the downtown district of the capital, as many of the Limeños have their places of business here. When Pizarro founded the City of the Kings, he selected a site far enough from the sea to be safe from buccaneers and pirates, yet only 8 miles from a fairly good harbor on the west coast. The first settlement, which was afterward destroyed by an earthquake and a tidal wave, lay to the north of the present city. Here, on the tower of the Castle of San Felipe, was the last place on the American continent over which floated the flag of Spain, the royalist troops having made their last stand here during the War of Independence. Callao lies on a bay shaped like a great half-moon and guarded by rocky islands. Part of the harbor is further protected by a stone mole built out in the bay. Just opposite Callao, lying parallel with the coast and less than 3 miles away, is the island of San Lorenzo, which someday, according to present plans, will be joined to the mainland. The water between the southern end of this island and the coast is shallow, and by building a breakwater, the two can be united to make a deep anchorage basin entirely protected from the sea, and large enough to hold any of the great fleets of the world. Callao has a large dock at which steamers and sailing vessels can discharge their cargoes, although many of the ships do as mine did and anchor out in the bay, landing their freight and passengers in smaller boats. As I went ashore at Callao, I counted 40 sailing vessels, loaded with lumber from Puget Sound and with grain, rice, and other heavy cargo. There were also many steamers, some Peruvian, some Chilean, and some from the United States. I saw a British boat of 12,000 tons starting out for Europe, and a Japanese liner from the Far East. Among the curious craft were three little war vessels of the Peruvian Navy and two submarines. Each year, about 1,500 steam and sailing vessels call at Callao. It is the port of entry for many of the imports into Peru, and the outlet for the copper produced in the famous Cerro de Pasco mines high up in the Andes. On the dock, I bargained with the cholo, or half-breed Indian, to take my 8 pieces of baggage to Lima. They were loaded upon a mule cart and transferred to the tramway, by which they were carried to the capital and thence by cart to my hotel. I rode to Lima by trolley, first passing through one of the wide streets of Callao. It was lined on both sides with trees, back of which stood low, flat-roofed buildings, built in blocks and painted in all the colors of the rainbow. Some of the streets were clean and modern, but many were dirty and smelly. For a long time, a common practice was to put garbage on the roofs and in the streets, where flocks of vultures acted as scavengers. These birds were protected by law, severe penalties being imposed on anybody who killed one of them. After leaving the city, we passed through orchards, gardens, vineyards, and fields of sugar cane and grain, surrounded by mud walls as high as my waist. The fields were irrigated by water from the Rimac River, and their bright green was refreshing in contrast with the barren mountains above. For much of the way, we rode between rows of willow trees, from which branches are cut off every year to make wicker baskets. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Lands of the Andes and the Desert by Frank G. Carpenter. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. On the World's Highest Railroad. As I dictate these notes to my secretary, we are both seated on an oil-burning engine on the very top of the Andes. The air is so thin that I can hardly talk, and even the roaring fire in the furnace beneath us does not take the chill from our bones. We are a short distance from Ticlio and near one of the highest railroad passes of the world. We are higher in the air than any mountain in the United States outside Alaska. We are 100 feet above the top of Mont Blanc and 2,000 feet higher than the sacred peak of Fujiyama in far-off Japan. If I could fly from here in an airplane north to Pike's Peak, I would have to drop three times the height of the Washington Monument before I could land on the summit of that mountain, and if I descended 1,000 feet farther, I would still be far above the height of Mount Mitchell, the highest peak in the Appalachians. Our actual altitude is 15,665 feet above the sea, and all about us are mountains that rise several thousand feet higher. Over there is Mount Meigs, the altitude of which is more than 17,000 feet, and not far away is another mountain of 20,000 feet elevation. We seem to be in a great fortification on the roof of the world. We are in a basin surrounded by gigantic walls of blue, black, white, red, and gray rock. We are also in a vast garden of glaciers. From where I am sitting, I can count a half dozen mighty rivers of ice, some of them so near that by standing up in the cab, I could almost throw a stone to them. These glaciers are of enormous extent. I can see one that seems to cover the whole top of the mountain, and near it another has burst out of the rocks and, like an icy shroud, has dropped itself down to the valley. A moment ago, the sky was bright blue. Now the wind has come up and the clouds hang low over the darkened ice. On these mountain heights, the sun of the tropics fights with the cold of the highlands in an endless battle. One can never be sure of the weather. It may be clear for a week, or it may snow day and night. In the winter, the mountain blasts are so fierce and the glare is so great that the trainmen have to wear smoked glasses to keep from becoming snow blind. This road is known as the Central Railway of Peru. It belongs to the government and is under the management of the Peruvian Corporation, a British company that operates more than half of the railroads of the Republic. It runs from Callao on the Pacific to Oroya high up in the mountains, a distance of 140 miles. There the road turns south to Huancayo, 78 miles away. It is planned to extend that line on to Cuzco, the ancient capital of the Incas, and already 40 or 50 miles of track have been laid beyond Huancayo. From Ticlio, the highest point on the main line, a branch 9 miles long, goes to the Morococha mines, crossing the range at 16,805 feet, the highest point reached by any standard gauge railway in the world. The Central Railway was suggested by a Peruvian, but the man who laid it out and constructed the greater part of it was Henry Meigs, an American. Meigs raised the money to build it, and in fact he is entitled to most of the credit for its construction. He began work on it in 1870, and in 1876, when he died, it was completed as far as Chicla, a point more than 2.5 miles above the sea. By that time, the $27 or $28 million that he had raised for its construction had all been spent, and the work stopped. It was resumed some years later, and in 1893 was completed to Arroyo. The extension to the rich valley of Huancayo was finished about 15 years later. The road was originally planned to reach the rich silver and copper mines of Cerro de Pasco, but it was not until some years later, when the mines were bought by an American syndicate, that a line was built from Arroyo northward along the high plateau of the Andes to that mining center. This railway is 90 miles long, and with the Arroyo Huancayo section covers a part of the Pan American Railway route, which is planned someday to span the entire 10,000 miles from New York to Buenos Aires. The Central Railway of Peru is considered by experts the most wonderful piece of railroad engineering on earth. It climbs mountainsides that rise almost straight up out of the sea. As the crow flies, the distance from the Morococha Pass to the ocean cannot, I should say, be 50 miles. Yet with all its windings, with its loops, twists, and turns, its zigzags and its tunnels, and the other contortions by which it climbs up the mountains, the rail line is only about 100 miles long. It makes the whole distance and the great elevation without the rack and pinion or cog systems used on other mountain railways, and with a grade of only about 4%. There is not 1 inch of downgrade from the sea to the top, and there is no place where a train or a car, if left on the main line, would not roll by gravity down to the ocean. As I have said, the track is of standard gauge, and the rolling stock used is largely of American manufacture. The engines burn fuel oil so that the journey throughout is accomplished without dust or cinders. The cars are equipped with an elaborate system of brakes which assures safety, and in the descent, a pilot engine always goes in advance of the train. Let me compare this line with some of the other famous mountain railroads of the world. The Denver and Rio Grande Narrow Gauge in Colorado reaches a level of 10,800 feet at Marshall Pass, but in doing so, it starts at a mile above the sea in the foothills of the Rockies, and after going some hundreds of miles through the gorges, it has attained an altitude that is still a mile lower than the highest rail on the Central. The highest point of the Transandine Road, which crosses from Chile to Argentina, is not more than 2 miles above the sea. In Africa, the Uganda Road, which, beginning at Mombasa on the east coast, goes over the divide to Lake Victoria, is several thousand feet lower. Between breakfast and dinner, the Central Railway of Peru takes one from sea level to a point higher than the top of any mountain in the United States outside Alaska, and if your heart can stand the strain and keep off the soraque or mountain sickness, you may ride in comfort all the way up. The ranges crossed by the Central Railway form one of the mightiest mountain systems on earth. The long chain of the Andes walls the entire western side of the continent. It begins at Cape Horn and the fjords of the Strait of Magellan, and stretches northward in a great winding rampart for a distance of 4,500 miles, where it drops down into the Panama Canal. Throughout most of its length, it has peaks 3 or 4 miles in height, and its average elevation is more than 12,000 feet, or almost the height of Fujiyama. Mount Aconcagua in Chile, the tallest measured peak in South America, is about 23,000 feet high, and Mount Misti in southern Peru is more than 20,000 feet above the sea. North of here, in Ecuador, You will remember that we saw many volcanoes, including Chimborazo, more than 4 miles in height. And to the south in Bolivia is a plateau that has an average elevation of practically 13,000 feet, with no drainage to either the Atlantic or the Pacific. These great altitudes are the most impressive on account of the steepness of the slope of the range that runs along the coast. It begins right at the sea, only a narrow strip of sand separating it from the ocean, and it jumps, as it were, into the clouds. The central railway follows the valley of the Rimac. In places the road is high above the river, clinging to the sides of the hills. Again, it is on the river level, and at one point, where the space was not wide enough for both road and river, the engineers made a tunnel through the mountains and turned the stream out of its course in order to use its bed for the track. There are 65 tunnels and 67 bridges, and there are 16 switchbacks located on the sides of mountains that the engines could climb in no other way. During the first part of the journey, the train took me through an irrigated valley. There were fields of alfalfa, sugar cane, and other green crops on both sides of the track, but the mountains towering above were as arid as the Sahara. I remembered the difference between the two sides of the Andes and thought that if I could bore a hole through the mountain wall, I might come out into the valley of the Amazon, where the waters swarm with turtles and alligators, and the land is covered with a dense jungle of palms, rubber trees, and all sorts of tropical fruits. Near the ocean on the western or arid side of the Andes, there is no green at all. The mighty rocks seem absolutely bare. By looking closely, however, I found gray cacti clinging to the rocks and silver-gray moss covering the stones like a mantle. These plants are probably fed by the dews. It was not until I reached Tambaraque at an altitude of almost 2 miles that I found the first sprinkling of green, which grew fresher and more abundant as we ascended. At 2.5 miles above sea level, the rocks were covered with a thin grass, and where I am now, at the beginning of the great plateau, there is plenty of feed for llamas and sheep. During the last 3 or 4 hours, we passed many wildflowers. At one place, I counted 40 varieties, and from where I am sitting, I can see buttercups and great yellow dandelions. As the train climbs the slopes, the Rimac Valley narrows and widens. In some places, one could almost jump from one side of it to the other, and again, it is so wide that it would take a half hour to walk across it. All through the valley are patches of crops. Near the ocean, it is quite wide, and there one sees cattle and sheep. There are some large fields with mud walls about them, and also haciendas with comfortable buildings. All the farms are irrigated. As the train went farther into the mountains, the fields grew smaller and smaller. Some were terraces where the cultivated strips were often only 3 or 4 feet wide. Nevertheless, these little farms extend far up the mountains, which are so steep that a workman who fell out of a field the other day rolled down 50 feet before he could stop himself. Even higher than these cultivated patches are the marks of other terraces that were used by the Incas, who tilled 100 acres where the modern Peruvians till 1. All the way from the ocean to the top of the Andes, I passed towns and villages. 25 miles from Lima, at an altitude of 3,000 feet, I stopped at Chosica, a summer resort, where a score of huge Chola women, clad in short skirts and shawls and white Panama hats, were on the station platform, selling oranges, tomatoes, peaches, watermelons, and strawberries. I bought 6 oranges at 3 cents apiece and paid a nickel for an alligator pear that weighed a pound. Higher still, we came to the Indian towns. There, all the houses were of one story, most of them being rude stone huts with rough tiled roofs. The people do not build their homes in the fields where every foot of land is needed for crops. Instead, they huddle together out on the edges of the valleys or on the rocky places close to rivers. They go out to work on the terraces and patches of soil, and now and then I saw them driving over the trails their llamas loaded with burdens. Here they were herding sheep while standing up and spinning wool, and there they were bent double in digging the soil. These Indians are short and copper-colored, and to me they look worked to death. The train stopped at Matucana for dinner. There we were served with plates of soup containing chunks of meat as big as my fist and a half dozen vegetables all stewed together. We had also beefsteak and eggs and red strawberries fresh from the vines. Here and there along the route were mining towns. Much of the ore, which contains silver and copper, is brought in on llamas, and I saw hundreds of those little camel-like beasts trotting along with their heavy loads. 13,600 feet above the sea is Casapulca, and the climb from there to Ticlio is more than 2,000 feet. Just below Ticlio is the Galera Tunnel, which goes through Mount Meigs to the farther slope. From here, one can throw chips into waters that flow to both oceans. I knew of this and had prepared two bottles, tightly corked, with messages in them. I put one bottle in each stream and set them adrift. One floated away down the eastern side of the Andes. It may reach the Ucayali, one of the tributaries of the Amazon, and go on its long voyage of 3,000 or 4,000 miles into the salt waters of the Atlantic. The other bobbed along rapidly toward the Pacific. It will soon reach the Rimac River, and if it escapes the rocks, it will be at Callao in something less than 100-mile journey. From Ticlio, it is only a short run to Arroyo, where the main line of the railway turns south to Huancayo, and travelers going on eastward must continue their journey by horse or muleback. An automobile road runs from Arroyo to the towns of Tarma and Merced, and from there a trail drops down into the tropical valleys where there are large coffee and sugar plantations. Between Tarma and Merced, the highway is strictly a one-way road. It is cut out of the sides of the mountains and is so narrow that two vehicles cannot pass. Hence, travel is eastbound one day and westbound the next. Arroyo is not a great distance from the tributaries of the Amazon River, and the day will probably come when this road will form a part of a railway route across South America. It has been estimated that the road could be extended to the navigable Amazon system for something like $15 or $20 million. Some claim that the cost of pulling trains over the great ranges will make this route impracticable for the movement of heavy goods over the Andes. There is no doubt, however, that East Andean Peru will eventually have railway connection with the Pacific. There are several passes much lower than that at Ticlio, and there is one where the altitude is below that of Mexico City. It can be reached by an extension from one of the valleys of northern Peru and the road built thence to the Amazon. The distance from the Pacific by this route would be only 400 miles, or less than the trip from Boston to Baltimore. Another plan is to extend the Cerro de Pasco line through the Ucayali River, a distance of a little more than 200 miles. I have already spoken of the possible extension of the railroads in Ecuador to the Amazon Valley, and it will be readily seen that if any of these projects are carried out, the vast region of the eastern Andes will sometime be accessible to us through the Panama Canal. In addition to one or more lines connecting the west coast with the navigable rivers of eastern Peru, the railway development plans formulated by the government include two longitudinal railways. One of them is to follow the line of the coast through the desert and the oases, and the other to be high up on the plateau, running northward from Cerro de Pasco and southward to meet the railway that now reaches Cusco from Arequipa. Much of the government railway thus far constructed has been financed by the income from the tobacco tax. Almost all of trans-Andean Peru lies within 500 miles of the Pacific Ocean. When the existing railroads are extended as planned, it can be reached from New York in 15 days. As it is now, it takes 3 weeks by ocean and river steamer to get to Iquitos, the port for eastern Peru, near the headwaters of the Amazon. Iquitos is the capital of the great Peruvian province of Loreto, which occupies most of Peru east of the Andes. It is the commercial headquarters of the Putumayo rubber region. Although more than 2,300 miles inland from the Atlantic, it is one of the chief rubber ports of the world and exports thousands of tons every year. The Amazon here is 3 miles wide, and at the $500,000 floating wharf of Iquitos may be seen many ocean-going vessels, as well as smaller river craft of all kinds. Next to rubber, the chief export is ivory nuts, which, as in Ecuador, are brought in on rafts and small boats over the network of streams. Many cedar logs also are shipped from here to be made into pencils and chests and boxes in the United States. Iquitos is a city of 15,000 people and has modern business buildings, houses of brick and concrete, and 4 public schools. There is a comfortable 3-story hotel that is among the best in Peru, and although the city is but a few degrees from the equator, the water and sanitation systems make it comparatively healthful for foreigners. Trans-Andean or Amazonian Peru, as it might be called, has an area equal to 50 states the size of Massachusetts, or 10 as big as Ohio or Kentucky, and the region has proportionately more good land than any of those states. Although near the equator, it has a climate that varies from the temperate to the tropical. Coffee and cacao can be grown in the mountains, while the lowlands produce rubber, and there are vast tracts where sugarcane, tobacco, and cotton can be raised. The country is also rich in minerals, and much of the gold of the Incas came from there. End of chapter 11.